When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming, episode 167. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I'm heading down to Oxfordshire to talk to farmer, academic, and I'm going to say Renaissance woman, because I'm not quite sure how to cover all the other things you do, but we will get to them shortly. Sally Ann Spence, how are you?
Hello, I'm very well, Will. How are you doing?
I'm very, very well, and as this is a podcast, people will not be able to see, but you have a jackdaw on your shoulder, and you're the first guest to bring. And it's very, very cool. What's his name?
This is Harry. So Harry was part of being on the farm means that animals tend to appear here, not necessarily the ones we guaranteed to arrive. But Harry was a day-old chick that was found inside a boiler, and the people that found him weren't sure what to do, so he came to me. As I've reared quite a lot of animals and wildlife, and we reared him, and Harry is unable to go back into the wild simply because it's so imprinted on humans. They live in a very structured society, and Harry's society is around us and not other jackdaws. Doesn't speak jackdaw, doesn't understand jackdaw, has his own little language, and that, of course, is rather problematic for release. Harry is free to go, can go in and out, not at the moment because of avian flu, so he's under lockdown with the rest of us. But being in lockdown with a jackdaw is quite something. But he has, he can go in and out as he wishes, but he had a run-in with a sparrowhawk, so he's not very keen on the big outdoors and tends to stay indoors. And he's very spoiled. He has a daily bath, but only if it's warm water in the winter. He shares the kitchen with a whole load of other animals, actually. He's my little sidekick.
Yeah, really. Very, very cool. Tell us about the farm and whereabouts you live.
So we live on the Oxfordshire, Wiltshire, Berkshire border, which is quite interesting, being in three counties. Mm. The family farm. I've my family farm up in Suffolk, and I met my husband at Ag College. And as is the way with farming, one of us had to move to one farm, and I moved out to his farm. Where he farms a family farm with his own family, and they're farming just about 2,000 acres in all, and that's in land that they own, three-generation tenancy and farm business tenancies. So it's sort of a bit full on. And then within that, there is 100 acres of grassland.
Okay.
And that's where I come in, and I also rent a further 100 acres of grassland. So I'm running about 200 acres of grassland.
Yeah, and that grassland is quite special, isn't it? It's calcareous grassland.
Yes, calcareous grassland. Yeah, so it's a chalky grassland with very light, loamy soils over the top, very, very shallow soils.
Okay.
And I come from an area where I've always been into conservation, always into ecology, always into the environment. I had one of the last feral childhoods, you know, the proper feral childhood. Didn't have a mobile phone, would sleep out overnight, get lost. My parents they weren't concerned, but they aren't. The parenting was slightly different then. You could go off and do things.
Yeah.
And I had a donkey, which was like my equivalent of a car at the time. And I could go travel great distances on my donkey. And then I graduated up to a pony and so on and so forth until I actually got cars. So... and I had loads of pets in the wild and basically just had a great time poking around in ditches, woods, muck heaps, you name it, I was in it. And that's probably where my love of everything came from. And you had time to grow up amongst all of that. My parents were very busy. We lived in the middle of nowhere. Mm-hmm. So we didn't go on holiday a great deal. And it was very much a case of finding your own amusement within that environment of the farm and the countryside, which is what I did. That then meant that I grew up and went into sort of agriculture and ecology conservation, Not sure where to go exactly in that world, but I did go and spend some time with the Suffolk Wildlife Trust working on a place called Redgrave and Lobham Fens. And okay. I very quickly got excited about rare habitat, shall we say. I was really lucky. I mixed in with a bunch of people who were really, really excited about the Fenland. One person in particular, she was amazing, Dr. Helen Smith, and she really got me excited about rough spiders and things like that. I think she now knows how much of an effect she's had on me. At the time, she probably didn't. And I went out with this great chap called Arthur Rivett. We went back, you know, looking at bats and all sorts of different things, but it was great. And I learned a lot about habitats within habitats.
Okay.
That changed my world hugely, because when I came up here, I went out and they had these amazing coombs, and they're sort of dry valleys from the last ice age, basically, from the melt of the last ice age. And they are chalk hills that have been cut into by the water, the defrosting mechanism. Mm-hmm. And they are these incredible shapes for a start. It looks like someone's got a piece of paper, scrumpled it up, thrown it in the bin, got it back out and unscrumpled it.
Okay.
And you've got amazing shapes. And then they don't look much. They look just grassy. And that's it. But if you actually get down on your knees, the grass is full of lots of different types of plants. Wow. And then, of course, you've got different types of insects. And they are wildflower meadows, but more alpine-based, if you like. So the plants are very, very small, very short. You get things like short-necked thistle. You know, they've actually got, you know, these tiny little dwarf thistles and things. So to they're full of flowers and they're amazing habitats, but you have to get down there to look at them. And they've been overlooked. And it's one of those habitats where post-war, when the country was in dire straits of food, and, yep. and this was really serious, so people really were starving around places, mm-hmm. like Jersey and things like that. So they were encouraged to plough up their land, and they were encouraged to maximise their outputs. And all these wonderful new agrochemicals and all these sort of artificial fertilizers and everything were there. And it was an amazing thing. You could turn this land round and produce a lot of food, which was required at the time. You also had a lot of men that didn't come back from the war and various other things. So these areas suddenly became isolated because the grassland that was on the flat above them could be ploughed, could be turned over, could be turned into agricultural land. And then these banks were all that were left, really, these areas you couldn't get a tractor in. And they either became naturally rewilded and they became brush and then they became scrub and then they eventually became trees, or they stayed as grassland because someone's put some suckler cows or something on them, a bit of grass. And what you've ended up with is a very rare habitat that's incredibly fragmented. And the biggest area of precarious grassland, like mine or similar to mine, is Salisbury Plain and Portland Down. And there's one reason why that is still there, hasn't been built on, hasn't been forested or anything else. It's because the army are there.
Right, okay. So
it's a very, very rare habitat. And so when I came down here and realised that we've got this incredibly rare habitat right at my doorstep, I was like, wow, you know, how many people walk into a scenario where they've got one of the rarest habitats in Southern Europe?
Yeah.
And it's on our farm. So I saw it in very different eyes to how my husband's family, who have been here for generations, see it.
So how do you manage that grassland?
Well, first of all, when I took it on, it was still you were still able to fertilise it. So this environmental schemes have changed since I've been here. But originally, they were still able to fertilise it. So they would fertilise the bottom bit, they'd fertilise the top bit, and try and flick it over the edge.
Okay.
And the reason they're doing that is because at the time we had a dairy farm here, a lot of dairy farms. So there's only about two dairy farms left in the whole of my valley. Whereas when I moved here, there was lots of them, and we were one of them as well. They would fatten the sort of, you know, turn out the young stock and things like that, and the dry cows and things on this bit of ground.
Okay.
So it had a use. And if you fertilized it, you had the grass growing quite well. So that's what they were doing. And then my father-in-law also ran a few sheep on it. And then the cows went because BSE came along and we rented the dairy, and we needed to spend a lot of money to get the dairy up together, to have relief milkers and things come. And our landlord wouldn't necessarily help us with that. So basically we had to get out the dairy, and it was to say BSE was just starting as well. And then my father-in-law decided to give up on his sheep. And we had a grazier come in, and he was grazing it. And that went okay. And at the time, I was still very interested in the ground, but I was not here as much to do things with it myself. I got the children coming along and various other things. And like a farmer's wife, I was trying to do a million different things to earn a few pennies. I was also trying to educate and do all sorts of different things. So I didn't get the time to look at it. But then as time went on, and I was got more and more involved in dung beetles, which is something I'm quite passionate about, I was going all over the UK surveying dung beetles. And I was surveying all three groups of dung beetles we have in the UK. And one group in particular are true scarabs, so a bit like the little Egyptian scarabs, lovely little tiny yes. versions of those. And there's only a few species, and only, well, I'm trying to think, there's six species in that group. Four are doing okay. Two are quite rare. And then we've actually had others that have gone extinct. So on my bit of ground, on the ground next door to my bit of ground, there I found a tiny colony, a tiny population of one of these particular dung beetles.
Okay.
And I was delighted because they're called Ontophagus joanni, which is one name that everybody else can pronounce. So I was really pleased about that. A lot of the dung beetles nobody else can. So, and I decided that I wanted to know the fact, now I had this understanding of how rare these beetles were, not just this species, but lots of different species were around the UK and their population and a bit more about their ecology and everything. I wanted to do what I could to restore Microcharis grassland so this population could grow. And I then put it into a whole research program. So we removed the grazier off there. He was running mules, okay. which is a fed hybrid sheep, yeah. a commercial animal, very woolly, few foot problems with them and various other things. But, you know, big milky ewes, female sheep, producing lots of milk and lots of lambs and a quite a quick higher or better, hopefully, turnover. And I looked at putting the indigenous sheep breed back on the hill, and up here it was Wiltshire Horns. In fact, mm-hmm. at one point before the war, before the wool trade nailed it, because we've got Marlborough and all these lovely wool towns around here, Wiltshire Horns were 700 over 700,000 Wiltshire Horns were running on these hills.
Wow!
So big amount of sheep. Yeah. We think they came over with the Romans, we're not quite sure, but they're a haired sheep, not a wool sheep, so they don't produce a fleece. And that's brilliant for me because that means I don't have to treat them for fly strike mm-hmm. hardly at all. It means that I can cut down on my treatments because treatments affect dung beetles. It also meant that these sheep have got very good hard feet and I'm not getting the foot problems with them. So that's excellent. So I'm not having to shear them. I'm not losing money shearing sheep. But they do like the warm chalk, which, of course, you know, this chalk is limey, very thin soils. So close crop ground. So it's quite warm. So they're really well suited to this environment. And that's why I got those sheep in. And then, of course, we stopped the fertilizing. And then I had to start looking about how I manage the ground for without the fertilizer on it, because that changes the production of the ground. So now I've got less grass and I'm trying to build up my sheep. And I'm building up a flock of sheep that are rare, probably for the reason that they aren't. The breed standard says they're very milky. I must have a totally different strain of Wiltshire Horns to a lot of people. Mine aren't that milky. They really do well with one ewe lamb rather than two. Triplets is not going to happen. And if I do have triplets, then I will remove some off and sell them off as cades, what we call cade lambs, because it's not so good for them to rear so many. And then when I built up the flock, I got my sheep in and I thought, right, I need to know how I treat them for parasites. So I'm going to go through my sheep as individuals and I'm going to see who has a naturally high parasite burden.
Okay.
Because I don't want to breed from ones with naturally high parasite burden. And I want to see if I can decide or find out whether this runs down in lines or whether this is something that one sheep might have and then a totally unrelated sheep might have and then somebody else might have, or is it going down family lines? And so I went through a lot of research and working out what to do, fish leg counting, blood testing, all sorts of different things on individuals kept in individual grazing areas and sold those sheep out. So I had this closed flock of sheep that were going to have as least input, but also you have a lower output, but also I was degrading the quality of my grazing almost. I was actually taking all these artificial fertilizers out and restoring it to the grassland that it should be. So for a lot of people, that's a funny thing. So I have to also be careful that when I go and speak to farmers, I don't stand there and say, oh, you must do this and this and this. It's great for your biodiversity, but you will make no money whatsoever. Yeah. Because that's not realistic. And that was the great thing about being a farmer, have my farming boot on as mm-hmm. well as my ecologist boot on. So I then looked at cattle, what cattle we could bring in. So we brought in Dexters. And the reason for that was because my son was obsessed with cows and he was 7 at the time. And we got a really old Dexter because they're very, very short. Yes. So we got him a Dexter. He got hugely into it, joined the Dexter Society, showed all over the place, bred county champions and show champions and all sorts. And we now have a herd of really good pedigree Dexters. But again, there is a problem. These are small cows. And when you butcher them or do anything to sell them for the meat trade, you're charged the same prices as if you've got a big beef animal. And so you're looking for a maximum premium profit on, you know, or maximum premium price for your product. And although we've got an amazing story to sell, it's very hard to get it out there. Mm. And if someone wanted to buy my beef that's not local, it's very hard to sell it to them because of traveling it and et cetera, sure. et cetera.
Yeah.
So then we looked at the cattle and we needed to get bigger cattle, but we have no real barns for the cattle because the barns here are workshops or grain stores or anything yep. like that. We wanted a bigger animal that could also benefit the grass, what I'm trying to do with the grassland, restoring it, and also be a better profit margin. So we started to move into Belted Galloways. My son is now 6'7". and even Belted Galloways look a bit small on him, but we've now moved over to Belted Galloways and we're actually changing the herd slowly over to pedigree Belted Galloways. And again, the pedigree is simply because he loves his showing. So that's why we've gone down that route. And then the sheep, again, you've got these sheep that are producing single lambs, not very milky, excellent for the ground, suiting the whole experiment and research I'm doing and the restoration really well. But the profit margin at the end of it's a bit a bit low. So again, you know, I need to market conservation. And there's this saying I was told when I was a kid that to be in the green, you have to be in the black.
Yeah.
And so I've crossing the Wiltshire Horns now with a Welsh mountain sheep called Cleans. And we keep back the ewes that are fleeceless, they're much milkier, got a bigger carcass, and they're having twins, but they're still doing well on the grassland. Because the whole time that I'm working on the grassland, I'm to restore the grassland, I'm having to take what we call in farming world the goodness, you know, this mm-hmm. vigorous grasses and all that sort of thing, all that's having to comb to allow this amazing, very fragile ecosystem to expand. And I've been doing this for the last, getting on nearly 20 years now. And we've restored, there's 100 acres up there that it's now being put into all sorts of different schemes because it ticks all the boxes. And I have some land up next door to me on exactly the same topography, absolutely the same cattle. It's got sheep on it. It's got, you know, all sorts of things going on, very similar to me, but not being managed for the species of beetle. I'm managing this whole thing, this one species of beetle. And my floral count has gone through the roof compared to my control, if you like, across yeah. the fence. My invertebrates have gone through the roof. Had an effect on the birds and the mammals as well. So it's really, and reptiles. We've got an awful lot of lizards and various mm-hmm. other things going on. So it's been a really exciting project. I've probably rambled off on this because I get very excited about it. But it's been a really exciting project and I have to see it through for my lifetime because I have to see how it goes.
Yeah.
I don't want to stop and say, right, this is it. I've made the mecca for wildlife and for farming because I don't know how it's going to go in 5 years' time. So it's something I want to run for longer. And the problem I had was I needed to do really good surveys on things. You know, I know about my dung beetles and I know about a few other things, but I don't know every single lichen species. I don't know mm-hmm. every single moss species, you know, and even, you know, some of the bees. I mean, we've got hundreds of species of solitary bees. You know, I need experts. So I set up research centre in my house, which is expanded into the barns next door to my house, which is where I'm sat now, surrounded by microscopes and samples and all sorts. I get people, experts coming in, and they run lots of different workshops. One of the load of workshops we run is conservation ecology workshops, teaching people how to identify species. So I might have a bee expert come in from the Bumblebee Trust, someone like Richard Comment, and he'll come in and he will teach about bees and how to do bee lines. And you can be a farmer and we'll teach you how to do it on your farm. We'll teach you more about what you need to know as a farmer for bees. We can have general public, anybody with a bee interest, come along and teach them what they can do for bees and how to run bee lines and all sorts of different things. And then you will have a practical at some stage during that day. And that practical is going to be up on my grassland and in my woodlands and things. So I get my species lists. And that way everybody's happy, because you can't do conservation for free. Everybody wants to know what they've got on their farms, but it's actually really hard. I really appreciate that now in my entomology, because I can walk out on the field and I might do 3 hours I could do an hour of sweeping with my net and perhaps set up a pitfall the night before or a week before, and perhaps put some sort of other trap up as well. It will take me weeks and weeks and weeks, and I have to draw in other people to actually identify everything that I collect. And you need to do that 4 times a year to do a proper, you know, entomological survey. So I also knew that I couldn't expect people to do this for free. And so this way, everybody's happy. I get the data, they get paid to come here, and also other people go away with more knowledge. So it's a win-win in that respect.
Do you find that farmers are more and more interested in this sort of thing? Because when I was sort of coming through, I went to Harper Adams in the early 2000s and did a course in agriculture, and the environment and nature just wasn't mentioned. You know, I don't think it was mentioned in the whole time I was there in the course. It was just the way it was. But, you know, now you look on social media or conversations with other farmers, everyone's talking about what more they can do. And I think everyone is conscious of it, but a lot of people are maybe not quite sure how to go about it, because a lot of us were brought up in that production ag era, weren't we? So do you find that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, traditionally, the farmer's daughter, you know, my role would have probably been going off and joining FWAG, which is Farming and Wildlife Advisory Group. That's where the daughters tended to go that had my interests. You know, you went off to Natural England or whatever, you know. And I think that this is a really exciting time. I'm now being pulled in to talk to lots of farm cluster groups that are being set up all over the UK. And these groups are only being set up and are only viable because of the interest of the farmers going to them and accessing them and using that information. I spend a lot of my, I mean, I must admit, I'm finally sighing a big sigh of relief that biodiversity is a buzzword and that we're now looking at farming. Yeah. But I'm also realistic. We do have to make these farm businesses work. And that's really important. And we have to make a business that can be generational as well. And I really don't think there's a farmer out there who wants their children to grow up in a world that hasn't got any wildlife in it. Mm. I'm absolutely certain that's true. And when I talk to any farmer, even our big Lincolnshire, if you like, big ag boys, you know, they'll still say, oh yeah, you know, the lapwings were out there or whatever. Mm. You know, you're out in your fields all year, whether you're an arable boy or whether you're a livestock, you know, you are well aware of the things going on around you and the species and whether they're there or not. Yeah. And I'm having farmers coming up to me and saying, you know, I'm really into dung beetles now. I didn't realize they existed. Now I can see you're doing them and there's a bit of science behind them. And they are, it's wrong to say that farmers are humans, just like any other person. We must get this right. A lot of people say, well, farmers are this, farmers are that. You know, the farmers are lots of different people, just like anybody else. Yeah. But farmers need to make an income from their ground that they're on. And this is why I'm passionate about putting in conservation things that will work, because then it'll get an uptake and it'll happen. And farmers want to do that. They do want to do these conservation schemes. They do want to have a better environment around them, for their family, for their future, their grandkids, their great-grandkids. You know, they do have an interest. Even the ones who you think would just sit on their big tractors and want to sit on them all day and, you know, GPS up and down their fields, whatever, they are still got an interest in their soils, in their plants, and they will have an understanding of everything else as well. What we need to do is not market biodiversity, but get people to understand that it is a big part of their farm. And they are very open to this because they're not daft. You know, they do want to see their wildlife around them. So, you know, it's things like, we understand now the importance of worms, earthworms in soil health. They're only little tiny wiggly things, nowhere near as nice as my dung beetles, but, you know, they're there. And we all worked out that actually they're en masse, they do an awful lot of good for our soil health. So we everyone's quite excited about them. And that's the same with, you know, how I'm marketing dung beetles. They're only tiny, but there's lots of them. And what they're doing is phenomenally important for the farming business. And I know we shouldn't put a price on nature and we shouldn't market nature. It's got, you know, this sort of thing. But you have to have, it has to have a value for an uptake of interest. Because these guys are up against the board. They're working 24/7. They're being bombarded by lots and lots of different schemes and ideas. And you must know this about soil health. You must know this about your grass lays. You must know this about your genes and your breeding animals. You must know this. And this. It's just, it's huge amount of information being thrown at them. And then there's some little person saying, oh, and don't forget the so-and-so bug, you know. So you've got to, you've got to put it across sensibly. And you've got to be able to say that, you know, we need biodiversity, and farmers know they need biodiversity. They know that they need healthy soils. They yes, there are situations where sometimes it's not ideal. And there is cases where, you know, I've seen maize grown on hillsides that probably shouldn't have maize on it. Mm-hmm. But then when you actually start to talk to them, you realize that they had no choice but to put it there. They didn't want to put it there, but they had no choice, and it's going to be too expensive to buy in maize silage from someone else. They had to get on it that day because they were actually had a contractor coming in to do the work, not them. That was the only day he could get in. They know it's got on the road. They know it's at their top soil. They're not being blind to this. Yeah. And then they're nailed on social media because, you know, that's the world we live in. It's trying to get the farmers want their biodiversity, they want the soils, they want their air, they want their plants, they want all the good things as well. But it has to mix in with the farming calendar, and it has to mix in with the farming business. And they also have to deliver those profits, or to, because that's how their family lives, that's how their house is there, that's how their machinery is bought. You know, that's everything relies on, like any other business that anybody is got anywhere around the world, if you don't make a profit, you can't keep going. Mm-hmm. So they do want biodiversity. They want biodiversity that works for them, with them, that they can work with. And they want to encourage things. They want more species. Definitely the feedback I'm getting, people are like, how can I do this to get more of your beetles? How can I do this to get, you know, this go and that to go? So the interest is huge. But I think the interest has always been there. I think that now it's got a spark and it's enlightened, and it's people are going for it. You know, I was at the Royal, I went to Shuttleworth College, and in my heyday, and I went on the Rural Environmental Management course, which was the very first course that they ran on a green subject, shall we say.
Sure.
And I was there. I think they had a baptism of fire because they had virtually no farming people on this course. And there were a few things that went on that certainly were quite entertaining, probably not repeatable for this, but when I got talking to my fellow real agrics, you know, the ones with the Dixie horn, the collars up on their rugby shirt, you know, proper agrics, and actually you have a sensible conversation with them, and they were very much even then saying, yeah, actually I can understand where you're coming from, and this is something that we can't do. When you talk to farming, especially in farm, if you've got so many different types of farms in the UK run in so many different ways. And you've got this big estate, well, not even a big estate, but the state is somewhere that's run by a farm manager, will have a different view on than a family farm that has been in the family for generations.
Yeah.
Because you have a connection that's slightly different. There is a huge uptake on environmental schemes. My worry is how many schemes we put out there that actually are quite hard to implement and are hard to keep going. And in which case you make an environment, that wet corner in the field, you know, let's turn it into a pond. Brilliant. Let's turn it into a pond. We get some money to help us do that. We tick in a green box and we're making a habitat. Mm. And it's brilliant and it's awesome. And then all these things come and they populate it. You've got this wonderful habitat going on. You've got these lovely flowers. You've got, you know, lots of bugs and beasties. Remember, I talk about the little things. There's lots of them. And then the scheme sort of peters out. And then somebody else comes in to perhaps run the farm, perhaps the farm sold, or perhaps the next generation come along and they do have a say on how they want to do it, and the scheme's not actually great and all the rest of it. And so they can do what they want. And so basically they take the pond out, they drain the corner, and they crop up to the edge again. And that could happen. Mm. And what you've created then is a local extinction. Because you've removed it. So it's getting, you need to put things in place that will stay there forever. Not force it to be stayed there, but to look at farms in a way where we can say, right, these are the backbones of this farm is this stream. They're never going to be able to get rid of the stream. So let's work on what we can do around that stream. And then we can bring things out from that stream to increase the biodiversity. And then the farmer's thinking, right, okay, so I've already got a good place. I can make that better without even having to lose any of my arable land. Mm-hmm. And okay, so you want me to, you know, obviously we've got buffer zones and things near watercourses, but basically, you know, you want me to increase a little bit more. And you're saying that I can have beneficial insects in there, and they could come out and they might start nailing the problem I've got with some aphids or something else like that. I need something that's really going to chomp on flea beetle, but, you know, there are a few things. But, you know, and then you think, right, okay, you know, that's how this is working. And that's how we need to look into it. Because when we do conservation work abroad, if we go into a third world country, we will often say we'll empower them, we'll educate them, and we'll give them the opportunity to put something in place that they can manage and they can make a profit from. And that's how it's going to go on. So we're not going to just give them, say, a beef, you know, meat or milk or whatever. We're going to give them a cow. And we're going to get them to have the cow and keep some grass back and do all this sort of thing. Whereas in this country, we say, right, you're going to do it, and you're going to do it this way. And we got to understand that biodiversity is something that's huge. People want it on their farms, and they want to do it in a way that it doesn't be detrimental on their farming process. So it's got to be, we've got to bring things in carefully. In a way that it will have maximum uptake and stay the longest. And that's really, really important. And I'm being approached by an awful lot of farmers now and a lot of cluster groups to talk about how they can put things, simple things in place on their farm that do big things.
Yeah.
I mean, I deal with the little things. So you can do something quite small to do something huge for an insect group. And then that will also bring in its predators and their predators and so on and so forth. So if we can get the bottom things in first, then everything else falls in place. But if I can put it in a way that it isn't detrimental, and I have out of 10 farmers I speak to, 8 take me up on an idea, then we're making waves. Then we're doing conservation, then biodiversity is really going up.
Absolutely. So tell me about dung beetles for farmers. There's a group of you come together to form this group. Tell us about it.
Yeah, dung beetles for farmers is really exciting. I'm obsessed by dung beetles, and I've gone around and surveyed dung beetles all over the UK.
Yeah, well, what's cool about dung beetles? I had Claire Whittle here last summer, who's one of the group, who former podcast guest Claire, and you, who you know, she came here last summer to do some sampling here for dung beetles. And I don't think I've ever seen anyone so enthusiastic about anything in their life as Claire was about dung beetles. So, yeah, what's so cool about it?
So dung beetles are an awesome group. They are recyclers of a monumental scale. If we didn't have dung beetles out there, just think of the amount of dung that would be out there and all the issues and everything. And the best way to think about that is think about Australia. In the sort of 40s, 60s, you had the old corks hanging down from the hats because they had a fly problem and all the rest of it. And what happened was they had introduced cattle and sheep into a country that only had marsupials, and they didn't have the right dung beetles. The native dung beetles ate dung. Wow. And so all these hundreds of thousands of animals they introduced were producing all this dung, and the dung beetles weren't removing it. So pest species of flies, and I'm going to say pest species of flies because I know some very passionate fly people who will collar me if I say that all flies are a nightmare. Pest species of flies were able to breed within the dung because that's part of their life cycle. And then they got to these huge numbers, which caused all sorts of problems for Australia, massive problems. Loads of people off work, you know, companies not doing a full output, you know, absolute disaster. So they had to sort that out, and they sorted that out by introducing dung beetles from other parts of the world that could survive in those scenarios and eat dung, cattle dung and sheep dung. So that's how important dung beetles are. It brought a continent to their needs. by not having the right species of dung beetles.
Wow.
So that just gets that point out.
Definitely.
There, first of all. So we have three groups of dung beetles in the UK. We have the ones that live in it and the ones that live under it. We don't have the rollers. So, and that's why people don't think about the UK as rollers, because all they concentrate on is David Attenborough, which is well worth concentrating on, but we've got these balls of elephant dung being, you know, rolled across the desert floor, and you've got the ones that roll it, you've got the ones that try and steal it off the ones that roll it and all this sort of thing, but they're big chunky beetles and they're doing something quite fun. So we all concentrate on those. And we don't have them here, so therefore people think, oh, we don't have dung beetles, but we do. So what are they doing? So a real quick outline of what dung beetles are doing. Unbeknown to you, you're not noticing it, but dung beetles, first of all, are removing your dung. So that's allowing more pasture available to the animals to eat. So the quicker you move the dung, the quicker the pasture is available to eat. As they remove the dung, the ones that are bringing it, certainly, you know, all of them, but they're bringing it, releasing those nutrients into the ground for the root uptake for plants.
Yeah.
And they're also bringing the organic matter into the ground for all sorts of soil invertebrates and things as well. As they do that, the tunnelers are bringing the subsoil up to the topsoil. So they're mixing it up. They're aerating it. And as water comes along, you've got holes for the water to go in. Some of these holes are about the size of my thumb, can go down in light soil, so about a metre or so. Wow. So you've got water infiltration as well. That's really good for water quality too. So you've got that going on. And then, of course, as they're breaking down the dung really quickly, it's not able to ferment and produce methane, which is one of our greenhouse gases and things like that, so quickly, so much. You've also got them breaking up the parasite cycles, because if you break down dung really quickly, the parasites that travel in a cycle through the animal come out in its droppings, carry on their life cycle in the dung, they're migrating to the grass to be consumed again. They can't do it because their habitat, their microhabitat, the dung, is removed. So they haven't got a habitat to do that in. And then their food. Every damn thing eats my dung beetles. So I'm trying to conserve all these dung beetles, and I've got bats eating them, I've got badgers eating them, I've got owls and other birds, choughs and waders, you know, snipe, woodcock, you know, loads of things, even swallows going over the paddocks, you know, everything's eating my dung beetles. So they are also really, really important for biodiversity. You know, what isn't cool about dung beetles on that fact alone? You know, these things are really important, and they've got an economic value because of what they do. They've got a biodiversity value because of the food and everything that they do there and what they're doing for the soil health as well. You know, they are just packages of protein. They're just awesome little creatures. And what's been really exciting is that as I've gone around the UK surveying, a lot of the data from that went into the State of Nature report, which I think you might have heard of, the IUCN Nature report. And it came back with some pretty serious reading on pretty much all groups, actually. I mean, everything was touched. And dung beetles came up as being less than 50% of dung beetles are doing okay, you know, doing really well, basically.
Okay.
So we've actually lost species too. We've got locally threatened, regionally threatened, potentially extinct, you know, all sorts of, they're really having a bit of a hard time. And that's where I got interested in, because obviously I'm interested in livestock and pasture ecology and that sort of thing. So that was, okay, this is something we need to kick on with. And then I've banged on about dung beetles for quite some time. But I'm on my own. And then James got in touch with me and he said, I'm forming a group of people. He's been here. He's heard me talking about dung beetles. I've dragged him around looking at dung pats. Lots of farmers around looking at dung pats. Any farmer who gets to spend 5 minutes with me in dung pats is going to be a totally different person. So it was a case of, well, that's great. And he said, well, I'm going to get a vet on board. I'm going to get an ecology PhD student on board. I'm going to get another commercial mainstream farmer on board, you know, and all this sort of thing. And we're just about to be joined by two other people, which I can't mention right now, but they're really cool. He brought a team together, and that team is called Dung Beetles for Farmers. And what we're trying to do is get that that whole advocacy for dung beetles, the conservation message across, we're trying to work with vets and farmers as to how we can address the problems, because what is threatening dung beetle? Well, we actually, or everybody focuses on insecticides, and insecticides are having a detrimental effect on dung beetles. But actually, if you remove livestock, you've removed the habitat. Mm. So as we lose livestock from around our countryside, we're losing the habitat, and it's becoming more fragmented. If you have a change in land use, so you remove your livestock and you put Tesco's car park on top of it, you've lost your dung beetles straight away. And like I say, they're part of a food web, so you lose everything else that's connected to them as well.
Yeah.
And if you decide that actually you're going to keep harrowing your fields and you're going to plough it after you've had it as a grass layer or whatever, you're going to be opening up the soil, you're going to be exposing the larvae, you're going to be exposing the pupating adults, or imagos, anyway, the in-betweens, and some of the adults. So you're exposing them to predation, so that's affecting them as well. And then, yes, you know, absolutely very, very important is your insecticidal treatments. So when you treat your dog for fleas or your cat for fleas, or, you know, have your children a shampoo wash for their head nits or something like that, you're using insecticide treatments. Yeah. And they are absorbed and they are passed through. And with livestock, it's the same. For animal welfare cannot be compromised. No one would expect anyone to let their dog get in a terrible state because of worms. And that's the same with livestock. You know, the farmer's going to treat his animals. And they haven't been told about the impact on dung beetles.
Yeah.
And that's not the farmer's fault. And they've been using these various things. So what we're doing now is we're addressing it. And with the veterinary groups as well, we're addressing that and seeing what we can do to get the word out there on how these things can be used in a more sustainable way, because we're getting resistance coming up with some of these chemicals as well. You know, at the end of the day, they are insecticides. So as they pass through the animal, they pass into the dung. Things that eat the dung are going to be affected. And the thing that eats the dung, of course, is the dung beetles. So you get lots of other big beetles and things in dung, but the ones that are actually breaking the dung down are the dung beetles. And these treatments can affect their breeding capacity, can affect the navigational capacity. Some of them that are very sensitive, you know, that are sensitive beetles, and it's a high dosage or it's quite close to when the animal's dosed, it can kill them. So this is a big problem, and it's something we're addressing. So it's an exciting time, and being a part of a group, being able to do that, it's just my dream. I'm so pleased and so thankful to have the opportunity to work with the team. Definitely. To do that.
Yeah.
I've got my top on today. We have now just got our official tops. Whoops, Jack Dorn was older.
Well, you're speaking at Groundswell, aren't you, in June, yes. The Groundswell event. So I will try and go, and I'll try and come and see you, because is that what you'll be talking about this to farmers? Because you said that farmers don't realise where the cattle wormers and things. And I have to say, I didn't. When Claire came here, and you know, she was asking me about our worming program, things like that, and I just sounds so obvious now, but it's not something I'd given much consideration to. And then I mean, she again, listeners won't be able to see this, but she printed this all the dung beetles she found on our farm, and I got really excited. It was really exciting. It was really, really cool, and I found it really interesting. And then I started thinking about, you know, what we could do here and worming and what we could change and stuff like that. So I guess it's just having that conversation and getting that out there to farmers, isn't it?
It is. Like you just said, you know, I didn't know the effect it was having. No, you won't do, because no one's ever told you.
No, exactly.
You know, I'm only just starting to be able to go into universities, and especially now we're online, and I've got a group of students next week who I will be talking to in the livestock module about the effects of pasture ecology. You know, it's if you don't know, how can anyone be annoyed with you or cross with you or whatever? You just don't know. So it's our job to get that out there. And as I say, they have a huge impact. You're grazing beef animals, is it? Yeah. Are you grazing or dairy? Yeah. And imagine not having the dung removed. You hit that and start to call, you know. Now, I've been to islands and places around the UK, and islands are great because things happen very quick in an island environment. And if you remove something and it's far enough away, nothing else can take its place. So you can watch a whole system collapse, which is rather, you know, sadly exciting sort of thing. You can actually see things happening. And I've been to a place where I have seen what no dung beetles can actually do. And the end result was that it writes off the past. You cannot graze there. That's it. It's done. And so, you know, when you see that, you think, oh my goodness me, yeah, these things we're taking for granted, and most people who are farming don't know about, And I don't think that's detrimental to farmers, because I'm sure if you put somebody in a arable field, just pluck someone off the street and put them in an arable field and said, right, tell me if that's winter wheat, spring barley, or you know, oats, they wouldn't know. Mm-hmm. But the arable farmer would know exactly. It's that scenario, you know, you just don't know. As someone who studies dung beetles and entomology, I know. I didn't expect you to know, but I'm hopeful now you do know. We can do something about it.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, yeah, it's just, it's exciting to see what will come of it. So you're obviously incredibly passionate about entomology and dung beetles. And so I guess it's something you've kind of dedicated your life to, but not, hasn't always been the case. You've also done lots of other things, as we mentioned on the intro, and I'm going to read out some of them. Lecturer, artist, writer, candle maker, bone carver, Neolithic Bronze Age educational reenactor, stunt driver, and you've been on TV and radio. That's quite the varied career. How have you had time for all that?
Well, I'm one of these people that if an opportunity comes along, I take it. So yeah. I've been caving, I've been microlighting, I've been paramotoring, I've been in helicopters, I've done everything that comes along. I will do it. Things come along. So we had a guy, he was trying to set up a paramotor business when paramotors were very new to the UK, before they were under the aviational laws they are now. But he was trying to set up a business, and he approached us and said he needed a bit of space to do that in. Could he possibly borrow, you know, use a bit, one of our fields in the stubble grounds, just to start training people how to use their wings and work with these motors called parajets and things. And you've got two choices at this point. You can either say, well, three choices. You can say no, or you can say, right, okay, let's talk money. Or you can be realistic, look at this trap, he's trying to start up his business, and say, tell you what, you can have the field, so teach me how to paramotor, because I've never done that. So I've done things like that. And we have people come here, run a very open house. I do an awful lot to support students from every different thing you can imagine. And what I'll do is they will come here, and through them I get amazing experiences as well. I had an incredible archaeology student who came here. He's an experimental archaeologist. He came here for his first degree. He finished with his PhD. And in the time that he was here, he did lots of various things, which is how I ended up doing a bit of Bronze Age stuff with him, because he said, oh, you know, can you help me out? And I said, absolutely, I'll give you a hand and help you out. I work within lots of different organizations. I'm self-employed, and I'm very, very flexible, and I appreciate people, and I like to work in teams, and I like to bring out the best in people. I don't believe it's necessarily all about me, and I found that actually that's been very rewarding a lot of the time, because I've met some incredible people and been able to go off and do crazy things. And I've been lucky enough that I've been able to do that, really, because not a lot of people get that chance. And as I've done one crazy thing, I've sort of met somebody along the way who does something else. And then it becomes a point where people will phone me up and say, you know, I've got this one-off thing. I need somebody else to help me do it. Can you work for me for the day doing this? And I'll just say, yeah, if I've got that day free, then I'll move it around. Yes, of course I'll come and help you out and do whatever it is. So that's what I've done. The dung beetles on TV, we did Extreme Chocolate Makers, a Channel 4 program. And I had this lady contact me, and she wanted to look at some dung beetles. I'm an honorary associate at the Oxford University Museum of Natural History. She wanted to have a look at some beetles in our department. So she came in as a guest and a visitor, and we showed her some beetles and things. And I got talking to her afterwards, and I said, what you do. And she said, oh, well, I'm really interested in looking at beetles and things. She said, but I'm actually a chocolatier. That's what I do. I'm starting up a new business, and it's called the Edible Museum. And I'm making chocolates, handmade chocolates, and I want to make them like museum samples. So we got chatting, and very got on well. And then I followed her on Twitter, the magic of Twitter. And she followed me. And then one day she put up, I'm thinking of doing an insect in chocolate. Has anyone got any ideas? Well, it was like, really? So I said, it has to be a dung beetle. So she said, oh, I'll bear that in mind. And then about a year later, she got in contact and said, look, I've been given the chance to do a Channel 4 program get my business out there and everything, but I have to pitch it and I have to do something different to what everybody else is doing. Something that the program organizers might think, oh yeah, that might pique people's interest. And she said, I was thinking, could you give me a hand? So it's like, yes. And so the next thing we're doing chocolate dung beetles, and I got the Pasture Fed for Life organization in, and we did a big thing about that, and she got her moment, and I got a great experience and time and work and everything as well. So it's about just saying, no, come on, let's just go for it. If an opportunity comes along, why not? For it. If I can fit it in, if I can help somebody out, if I can fit it in, then yeah, I will help people out wherever I can, really. Definitely.
Yeah. And I've got to just ask you a bit more about the museum, because I'm a massive museum nerd. Whenever I go anywhere, I always try and go to the local museum. I guess it's been a difficult time for the museum, like it has for all of them this last 12 months.
Yes, very, very. It's the Oxford University Museum of Natural History the word says university. They're running lots of projects and research, and they have a colossal collection. Many collections, but obviously my area is sort of in the entomology. And that needs to be maintained. At the moment, they're moving specimens and sorting things out. So, of course, you've got all that behind the scenes. We can't just close the museum doors.
No.
And there's projects going on that have to carry on. So it's man management and everything like that. I haven't been allowed to go back to the museum at the moment, and I'm missing it all hugely. And then, of course, they're a public building and open to the public, and that's how they get a lot of their income and their events and things like that, which, of course, can't run. So, they're definitely struggling in that respect. But, they're getting around it. We've been in lockdown for so long now that a lot more online things and more of it, but it's not the same. It'd be great when we can all get back to normal and people can get back in there and be inspired by the collections.
Well, I hope it happens soon. The notes that were sent to me, I messaged you back and said, I'm sure this is a typo, but it says you are currently dead in the Corinium Museum. And you said, no, it's not a typo. I am currently dead in the Corinium Museum. So perhaps you could just explain that to listeners, please.
Yes, that came about. A friend said, oh, can you help me? I'm doing, he was doing a series of films, for educational films for a museum. And we've had films done here. So I've had people come here and to be filmed. So if you see the Havering Hoard in London, in the London Museum, the film that goes, the educational film, was filmed here. So things like that. And said, could I help out? They needed a woman, a dead woman, in a great scenario. And I'm to play a beaker lady. So in Cirencester, the Corinium Museum in Cirencester, they have just launched an incredible, they've just launched it just as unfortunately this whole lockdown, but it's still there and it will run for longer. They've got a prehistory exhibition, and they wanted films to go with things. And they've got a skeleton of a young lady who I'm very pleased to play a young lady who's a beaker burial, and she's got her grave goods and everything like that. So rather than just having the sort of, that exhibit, they wanted a film to go with it. And they've got the archaeologists who have been working on her, explaining about it. And then just to help the visitor visualize what she would have looked like in her burial state, they wanted someone to play that part. So my friend said, well, look, could you do this for me? Yes, I can. I'm in Graincart, but we're going to do that. They did the filming, not just on the farm anyway. I had to rush down, park up, quickly change in the trailer, run over, play my part. I even had to carry my own burial goods with me. and then jump back on the tractor afterwards and whiz off. And now, yes, you can see me. I'm immortalized with this amazing lady in the Corinium Museum.
That is pretty cool. Pretty cool. Yeah. Not many people can say that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
No, I think I do a lot to help students and things like that. I run all sorts of different weekends where we subsidize them and we get them together because of my links with people in the academic world and in the practical world. And what I'll do is we have students come here that I will have a whole weekend training them with lots of different specialists. It's a networking opportunity for them. It's a learning opportunity for them. And I get a lot out from helping those students as well. And we bring people together. One thing I love to do is bring people together, connect people, get that whole thing going, because academia is a very funny world. We talk about collaboration, but I've experienced that collaboration isn't always the way forward. And it's sort of run by the way the funding works. So you have to publish to get funding, but to get published, you know, and it's sort of this nasty little circle that goes around. And I found that quite difficult. And I'm quite keen on true collaboration, because that does get things going, but it sort of tends to give you a little bit of a bumpier ride. But that's one thing I've done, is make sure that we can help students, because I've had a lot to do with kids over the years, and people miss out on opportunities. And if I can have opportunities, and I've got so much here on the farm that I can give opportunities to others, then I will do that. And so that's how we come across a lot of these weird, wonderful things I do, is because I've been lucky enough to work with some incredible people over the years. And a lot of them have become, they've all become very good friends. So, very lucky in that respect.
If people are listening and they want to find out more about what you do there, it's Berrycroft Hub, isn't it?
Dung Beetles Farmers a shout out. I would be clobbered if I don't. So www.dungbeetlesforfarmers.com. Please check them out if I've excited you about dung beetles. And you should be excited about dung beetles. And you don't have to be a farmer to be excited about dung beetles. My main business, I'm about to do a new website actually, but it'll still be the same thing. It's www.berrycrofthub, berrycrofthub.com. And what I'm doing here is I host lots of research projects on the farm. We've got a talk coming up very soon about farmland birds. One of my students is going to be talking about the research we've been doing about songbirds and keeping dawn happening, the dawn chorus happening. But we have lots of students here. We do lots of events, obviously closed at the moment. And then we do workshops, and the workshops help fund some of the students that I can sponsor and look after and do things with as well. So it's going to be revamped, the website. That's one thing we are going to do now. We've managed to get a grant, so I'm very excited, because I've been obviously closed and I'm self-employed and all the rest of it. So I've sort of slipped out the grant net. Yeah. But I'm quite used to sort of grabbing work anywhere else that comes along. I work in research, and research doesn't always get paid anyway. So I sort of got used to that world that I live in. We're doing online talks. That's about the only thing we can offer at the moment. We hope to open soon, start doing the workshops themselves, but at the moment it's online talks. But if people would like to visit that website and join us on one of our talks, that'd be great.
All right. Well, before we wrap this up with the traditional five hard-hitting questions, I've just got to ask you. I've got to ask you, because you've got Harry there on your shoulder, and I have four Harry Potter mad children, and you have actually had some of the owls from the Harry Potter movies there, haven't you?
Well, I've had owls. They didn't come from the Harry Potter movie. There's a bit of a sadder story than that. They were the result of the Harry Potter movie.
Oh, wow.
When films come out that involve animals, often people ill-advised decide to go out and buy the animals for their children.
Oh, wow.
And my local raptor rescue centre got overrun with owls post-Harry Potter, the first Harry Potter.
People bought pet owls?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. Quite crazy. So they got overrun. So I took on a few owls, and we had Spook, Sarah and Alfred living with us for the rest of their lives. And it was great fun. One thing I did learn about owls, though, is that they're not as intelligent as we all think. The wise old owl is a little bit misleading. Jackdaw is definitely more intelligent. And at the same time, I breed insects and various other things as well. And I used to breed an awful lot of large tropical moths, so atlas moths and moon moths and things like that. And like Harry and everything else, I like things to go through. I'm not a great fan of things being caged up. But we did have a problem with the moths and the owls, so we had to keep the moths upstairs and the owls downstairs. Bored owls can be very destructive. They don't make good pets. So one thing I do want to get across is, you know, the animals I have are because people can't have them as pets. And there's a reason why. And these animals are not pets, you know. Don't go out buying owls for your children. It's really a good idea. as many of these things aren't, you know. So yeah, I do live in a bit of a crazy household, but it does mean that you don't go away on holiday like other people, and you have to be very selective on how you get anyone to look after them, and they've all got various issues going on. And yeah, I don't recommend that to get those sort of things as pets by any means at all.
No. Well, all I can picture is the we watched the new Dr. Dolittle movie not long ago with Robert Downey Jr. And I'm just imagining your place being like that at the moment.
It is,
animals and birds everywhere. Yeah. Okay, let's wrap this up in the traditional way with the five partisan questions. What's your all-time favourite song?
Right, well, I'm my music taste is all over the place because I like classical through to pop to rock, I mean, just all sorts. But I'm a big fan of Cat Stevens, but I think under COVID, now this is going to sound a little crass, but I think I'd go for the Will Ferrell Happy.
Oh, yeah, okay.
I think that's a song that I wouldn't mind singing and bopping to right now because it's so miserable out there. I'm going to go midway for that, yeah.
Okay, all right then. If you could go out for a night out with anyone from history, and it can be a quiet dinner at a nice restaurant or a night on the tiles clubbing, who would it be and why?
Oh, golly. As I say, I didn't have time to read up on these. So, well, I mean, you've got Darwin and Linnaeus and people like that. You've also got the underdogs, Wallace, and people that never quite got there. I think, actually, I would go for Mary Anning. Because Mary Anning, she didn't really get the recognition. Now, I'm not doing this just from a woman's point of view and all that sort of thing. I'm just saying she did not get the recognition that she probably deserved. She had a very hard life. I'd love to spend an evening with her learning more about the plesiosaurs and everything that she was finding. I spent many, many happy weeks down at Lyme Regis in Charmouth with my children looking for fossils and things. And I still get really excited if I find a fossil, no matter how big it is. So I would get her, and I'd actually take her on the tiles. I'd take her for a night out because that girl didn't get a lot of fun in her life.
Exactly.
So I think
Yeah, and we're all desperate for a night out anyway at the moment, aren't
Absolutely.
We?
Absolutely.
I'm going to assume, being an academic, that you are a book lover. What's the best book you've ever read?
Right. I have got books on loads of subjects. I've even got a book full of beetle penises, actually. We don't, the male body parts, because when you're keying out a beetle, that's an exoskeleton part. So So you can keep it forever, and you can, you know, they're all different shapes, and it's something you refer to.
I must admit, I've not read it.
No, there's well, you've got lots of books out. You've got very popular books like Rewilding by Isabella Tree. You've got, there's loads and loads of books. I love Richard Forty's books. He's got a new book. In fact, I've been in quite a few books one he did about his woods I did with him. Just trying to think, there's lots of books, but I think there was a book I read years ago called Year of the Cornflake.
Okay.
And I can't remember who it's by. I have to find out who it's by. And it's about a couple. It's a true story that about the 70s they went and bought a small holding and decided to run children's holidays on it. And I think if you want a bit of escapism, if you can find this book, I can't think who wrote it, that would be an amazing book to read because it's so funny.
Okay.
It's really, really good old pre-risk assessment fun.
You've travelled the length and breadth of the British Isles with your job. What's the most interesting place you've been?
Oh, now you really have got me on the spot because, I've met so many different characters and they made the places so much more interesting and things. The Orkneys were incredible. Mm. The wild scenery. I think the minute I got off the ferry and you could hear the flocks of birds, the curlews and everything. The just phenomenal amount of birds up there, proper flocks like you used to see, you know, just stunning. Scenery was incredible, very flat, very open, but absolutely stunning. And of course you had Maes Howe and the Nessa Brodmer and all these incredible sites. So that Orkney was amazing. But I've just come back in between the lockdowns, actually. My son really struggled at uni and he needed a break. And it was when we were able to travel. So I put a pair of my kayaks on the car and we kayaked round the coast of Argyll.
Okay, cool.
And you go past Jura and Arran and all these amazing... Yeah. I've got a thing for Scotland. I love Scotland. I love the islands up there. But then there's Wales. Wales is fantastic. If you go to Ffestiniog and all those places around Wales, you know, I remember I cold call farmers about their dung beetle surveys, you know, and they were great. I mean, bearing in mind, there's a complete nutcase turn up on their doorstep wanting to put their dung. But I do remember one farm in the middle of nowhere in, I can't even remember where I was in Wales. It would be in my data book. But I remember walking into this little old farm with the extremely worn Land Rover, and it still had all the old little farm buildings. And I walked through the courtyard to his door, and I knocked on the door, and then I heard the chain go, and this chain came out, and this dog came out from the other side of the courtyard, and its chain was just long enough to keep me at the door, but not enough to get the courtyard. And if he hadn't opened that door, I'd still be there. But then the Norfolk Broads and the Washes and, you know, going up to Holcombe and places like that. I mean, Kent, and then you've got the Sea Isle. Oh, golly, I don't think this. I mean, you haven't even started on Cumbria, have I yet? Or the Peak District or the Lake District? Or I don't think you can pin me to one place. I think we're very, very lucky in this country to have such incredible places. Yeah. And I don't think we really appreciate what we've got. We're so busy to go on a plane to get to a bit of sun. I mean, I do not like the sun. The sun, I just don't like the sun. It doesn't agree with me. Give me a bit of wet, cold, windy hillside any day of the week. So if I was going to settle for one place, it's going to have to be, I can't. I know so many people around the UK now, and I'd be upsetting them if any of them are listening to this. You didn't choose our place. No, I don't know. I mean, it's just Portland Bay. I mean, you've got some cool dung beetles down there as well. No, I can't. You can't pin me. I'm sorry. Okay. I cannot be pinned to one place. The UK is an incredible place. And even nipping over to Ireland and things, yeah, we're very lucky, and I'd be hard-pressed. I do have a joy of wild places and solitariness. I spend a lot of time with people, so when I get away, I'm very happy being in the middle of nowhere with no one. And I take all necessary precautions and everything, but I'm very happy in that environment. Okay. So for me, if you were going to pin me anywhere, it would be the wild places. That's my favorite place, the wild place.
The wild places. That I might even call the show that, the wild places. Okay. The last question, traditional way to finish. What is your favorite agriculture-related social media account to follow and why?
Okay, right. Well, I probably should have put some thought into this earlier. So definitely the Farmers of the UK. And there's an Irish version of that as well. Mm-hmm. That is really good because you've got different people from different areas of ag doing it all the time. And so it's a really good way of having an understanding of agriculture throughout the UK. And different age groups are taking it on. And you really have got it's a really good way to see how diverse farming is in the UK. Definitely. And it's a good showplace for those people to really let you know what they're actually doing on their farms and how they actually are running their farm throughout. You know, it's only a week you have it, but it's a really good account. So, yes, I think that's an exceptionally good account. You've got lots of other accounts like Pasture Fed for Life, Nature Friendly Farming, you know, all these other accounts as well. They're really good for farming from my point of view. Then you've got some of it's good to get a cross section if you're interested in farming. So you want to go to the big arable boys and the big beef boys and all that sort of, you know, the big sheep people. And then you've got there's loads of people. I should have had a list for this. I could have reeled off a whole list. I come back with a list because there are so many. But I think if you want to start straight away, is go to the Farmers of the UK account. If I had to choose one, I'd say that.
Sally-Anne, thank you so much for your time today. It's been lovely to speak to you. And I will try and come and find you at Groundswell and hear your talk on dung beetles. Keep up the great work.
No problem. Thank you for having me. And good luck with editing all of me into a tiny space.
Okay. Thanks again. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.